As back-to-school advertisements flood our airwaves and mailboxes, and our store shelves are full of notebooks, pens, pencils, and other important school supplies, the question remains the same. What does it mean to go back to school in a fall unlike any of us have ever experienced? I'm Ian Costello. It is Friday, August 7th. And this is the COIN Podcast Network coverage of the coronavirus pandemic.
From our studios in downtown Portland, Oregon, this is a COIN 6 digital exclusive.
This week, COIN 6 News took an in-depth look at what school will look like when classes start in just a matter of weeks. Today, four superintendents from major school districts in the area answer parents, students, and teachers' questions about safety, distance learning, when in-person instruction could return, and how to restart school during a pandemic. Here is the COIN 6 Town Hall, Kids, Class, and Coronavirus, What Parents Need to Know.
I don't want to go to any student funerals this year. I don't want to go to any teacher funerals this year.
It's a struggle to, you know, be trying to work, but then also have your child there and trying to make sure they're getting their work done and they're learning.
I am absolutely unwilling to lose an entire school year for any of our kids.
Unfortunately, many districts are recognizing that the rate of transmission is not where we would hope it to be to allow full-scale in-site or on-site instruction.
You want to be safe. I mean, there's a virus out.
Kids, Class, and Coronavirus. What Parents Need to Know. A COIN 6 Town Hall.
Welcome to our town hall, Kids, Class, and Coronavirus, What Parents Need to Know. I'm Jeff Gianola.
And I'm Dan Tilkin. For the next hour, we'll be answering questions submitted by you, parents and students and teachers, about the upcoming school year. We're joined with a panel of school superintendents from across our area who are here to address your concerns.
Now, our guests are Guadalupe Guerrero from Portland Public Schools, Christy Perry of Salem-Keizer, Don Grotting with Beaverton School District, and Mark Molino from Evergreen Public Schools. And thank you all for joining us.
This is certainly a rapidly changing situation. When we started working on this project, parents were still looking at choosing an in-person or at-home learning, and now we know that students in our area will be starting the school year online.
Now, you all share a passion for our students' education, and Superintendent Guerrero, let's start with you. How difficult has this whole process been, coming to terms with the health and safety risk of in-person classes, and then trying to shape an online model that could really have a long-term impact on our children?
Thank you for having us. There's a little comfort knowing that I share this challenge with many of my colleagues. We're going to continue to be guided by making sure that the health and safety of our students, our educators, our employees, that has to come first. Thankfully, we're in Oregon. We're paying attention to those things. We have worked and collaborated with the governor's office to ensure that there's some metrics and some health guideposts to help inform our decisions. I know that many of us are working closely with our public health authorities and gathered medical experts. We have to make decisions that are informed by the best data available, and we know there will be some variability. But as a school system, nothing motivates us like making sure that we're doing our best to comply with our core mission, and that's making sure that there's a continuity of learning for our students. And therein lies the challenge when we have to make decisions that our campuses simply can't guarantee safety at this time. So how do we switch up that delivery model?
Well, we live in a fascinating area because we have two states right next to each other, both trying to figure this out. So let's go to Mike Merlino from Evergreen. Let's talk about the state of Washington. The same question to you. How do you go about trying to come up with a plan that takes care of the health and safety and also tries to educate these kids?
Yeah, I think I would say the same thing as Guadalupe. We are fortunate to have a lot of folks in Clark County working together. We have our superintendents, I think, have worked quite well together, trying to do exactly what is happening in Oregon, follow the guidelines that were provided by OSPI, by the state of Washington. We've worked really closely with the Department of Health. I think for Evergreen, our priority, our goal from late May, June was to try to come up with a plan that provided the opportunity for our students to be in school on site, either in a hybrid model or full time. And it's absolutely, though, with the safety of our students and our staff at the forefront. And we really kind of worked hard at that. But unfortunately, just the level of growth of cases throughout Washington State, throughout the country, really, but even in Clark County, led us, our state's kind of changed the metrics a little bit, even in just the last few days, where we're looking more heavily at the cases per 100,000. And unfortunately, we kind of ended up at this spot with the remote learning. We want to have our kids on site, but I'm happy to say that the work that's gone on within the district with our administrative staff on building the plan with our teachers' input, we're feeling very comfortable with where we're at as we continue to work on the plan, that it's much improved from last spring, where we were kind of thrown somewhat to the wolves overnight. And even in that situation, I think we did really well. But certainly, like everyone else is going to say, the safety of everyone is at the forefront of where we're at.
Hey, Mike, thank you. Let's get to some questions from our viewers. And our first question, this was submitted by a parent. How is online learning going to be different than in the spring? You just heard Mike said it was sort of like you all were thrown to the wolves.
Right?
Yeah. So how will kids and parents be supported with online learning resources as we begin a school year? And Don, I think I'll go to you in the Beaverton School District.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Once again, a shout out to COIN for having us here. I believe when we started online learning in the spring, we were really just struggling to find out what it was. We were worried about connectivity for our students, devices in our students' hands. And we've had time since spring and now even over the summer to where we're really reaching out, making sure that our students are going to be connected, devices are going to be there, and then also providing our teachers the resources that they need to be able to reach out to their students, and also looking at wraparound services that each one of our students need, and that really needs to be differentiated. So I believe we are going to be in a lot better position, and our teachers are going to be better trained. We've had some times to really reach out to our parents, to our students, to our staff with surveys and find out what went well, but more so, where do we need to improve? And we've really learned a lot from those surveys and reaching out. So I believe when we come back, our instruction is going to be better. We're going to have better wraparound services, especially for our most vulnerable students. And we're going to go forward. Yes, there will still be challenges. And the only last thing I want to say is, you know, we've always wanted to say, you know, parents are their teacher, are their students' first teacher. Right now, we need the help of their parents and other guardians more than ever in helping us provide the best education that we can for each and every student in each one of our districts.
If we could ask Christy from Salem Kaiser, there's going to be a lot of folks who are good at this and a lot of folks who aren't good at this. How do you begin providing resources to people who are struggling, whether it's the parent or whether it's the student?
Right. So we learned a lot last spring with how to support parents. And one of the things we've done is we've had a couple programs this summer. For example, our migrant families, we have about 634 students in a virtual migrant summer school. this summer. And one of the things we really worked on out of our migrant office was to build relationships with parents, to help parents and support them in being their first teachers, and then be sure that they were equipped with an adult that could they could ask questions to, and that relationship would endure beyond the summer school. So that's one example. Our teachers did a lot of that teaching with parents last spring as well. So we think our teachers are coming in more equipped because they were thrown, or our parents are coming in more equipped because they were thrown into this like we were thrown into this. And so that's how we'll continue, is to really just work on supporting our parents. We did some surveying of our parents, and a couple things they told us. One is we need a common learning management system. We can't be on Google Classrooms and on something else. And so we will have a common learning management system for every student and their family, grades 3 through 12. Our younger kids have a different one. They also said too many classes. So we are doing fewer classes in shorter chunks of time in order to support students with not as many things to manage, and so we can go deeper into learning.
Okay, thank you for that. Here's another question submitted by a parent. So how will children meet their grade level? What will the benchmarks be by the end of the school year using this distance learning model? You know, a lot of parents say, are there going to be grades? Mm-hmm. A lot of parents say, no, that's unfair.
And how do you grade them?
And how do you grade them? In Guadalupe, that's a tough one. I think I'll go to you with Portland Public Schools.
I like how you prefaced it. It's a tough one, so we'll send it to Portland. The question that we're all contending with, if what we're interested in is maintaining that continuity of learning, and we believe that the teaching should be standards-based, there's a certain set of grade level expectations we have for our students, whether they're on campus or they're learning during comprehensive distance learning at this time. So this morning I heard clearly as we welcomed back our principals that they're anxious to reconnect with our students. I know that our educators are as well. We're going to take a couple of weeks to make sure that they have that opportunity to reconnect, to assess what the real needs are. And I also want to acknowledge this isn't just about the coronavirus pandemic. There's an accompanying economic crisis, and let's not forget a growing racial uprising. And so there are several factors that as school system leaders we're contending with. And so how do we make time in the schedule as we bring back our students, even if that's virtually right now, to make time for those conversations and be clear, as Christy said, about what learning platforms and digital resources we'll be using, and then really sort out into some schedules so that we're able to really dive into that grade level content. I think we all expect to be able to begin to dig into.
Mm-hmm. And now let's go to the state of Washington. Mike Merlino, let's get perspective on you, because we have these two different dynamics
here.
States. Same question to you, benchmarks and how you gauge them and grading, et cetera.
Yeah, so I think this is probably one difference in the plan as we come back in the fall. I'm not aware of how it was handled in Oregon, but in Washington, when schools were closed in the spring, basically it was announced right from the beginning that grading was suspended, grades were frozen at that point in time. Districts were allowed to determine kind of the grading scale, but not students couldn't go backwards. They could go forwards, but they couldn't go backwards, which was somewhat of a disincentive for kids to stay connected. I think our plan going forward is the first thing we need to do is we need to connect with every kid, every student in our system. I think our parents want to know what is different about our plan in 2.0 from what it is in 1.0. And I think we can't really rely on parents to go to even these types of forums. I think it's great we're doing this, but we want to start day one with our students hitting the ground running. So Dawn talked about technology. We're working hard now, making certain that every student's got their technology with them day one. And I'm very pleased with the work that our curriculum department has done in building these new schedules. We're still finalizing them. Our board will approve our plan for the state of Washington reopening plan next week. So I think there'll be more to come next week, but I think first of all, the fact that we will have a grading system in place is significant. We are expecting kids to advance. I think you can't I think it's pretty widely accepted that you can't get to the level of content online that you can in person. So a lot of the work that we're doing is looking at the state guidelines and trying to make sure that we're hitting the most important things as we do our work. But like all of us are facing, every day is a new challenge. And I'm real happy with the staff that we have and making sure that we're taking care of that.
Mike, you said something interesting about making connections. And one of the major things that kids are really missing during the pandemic is that connection, the play and socialization with kids their age. I mean, that's a very important part of school.
Yeah, whatever age group. Yeah. There's been a lot of talk in our community about learning pods, maybe micro schools to help kids with socialization and help working parents. So how do you feel about these options is the question, and will your district help parents connect with others? How about, this is kind of like a game of Hollywood Squares. So yeah. Let's go to Don Grotting with Beaverton, if you'd like to answer that question.
Yeah, thank you. So we understand that parents desire to provide additional supervision, especially the desire of working parents, and they certainly have the right to do that, and we want to accommodate that as much as possible. We also know that we have some families that may not have the means to be able to provide this type of additional supports for their students. So as a school district, we're trying to find out how we can possibly repurpose some of our staff to provide some of those supports to children that do not have the means to do so, and or parents to support parents. So reaching out, doing some parent support groups, and really focusing on those wraparound services that all of our kids need, and some of those students need more wraparound services than other. So we have been really working with our city, our county, state stakeholders in trying to develop resources that we can bring that will make their distance learning experience better, but also when we eventually, hopefully soon, go back into a hybrid model, they'll still need those wraparound services. So we support these type of strategies, but also we want to make sure that each and every child has access to these strategies. And we do not want to widen the disparities that Guadalupe already talked about. We already have great disparities. And one of our fears is when our students come back, we're possibly even going to see wider disparities. And how do we start closing that achievement gap and looking at language barriers, race, poverty in our school districts?
Don makes a good point. And Christy, I think I'll come to you in the Salem-Keizer district. He's saying the disparity, your district, what, 70% of the students at a poverty rate there. And are you worried about the disparity when some parents get together and are able to hire teachers and it leaves other parents who can't do that left out?
Yeah, we are. That's high on our minds. We are really making sure we provide, you know, access, internet, but also counseling services. We've kept our counseling kind of warm line active all summer for our families. We're already seeing this with families wanting to pull together music lessons for their kids, for those kind of who can afford. We have a project called the Music Lesson Project that we're going to really pay close attention to. They support families in poverty with a private music lesson when we're in person. So we want to now help support that virtually as well. And just again, that really intentional support. We have community outreach specialists that work with some groups of our kids, like our Islander community, our Native American community, our Black and African American community. And so those positions in our district are going to be more important forever. And at the same time, all the social interactions. One of our really big pushes is around, and biggest worries is around, our youngest learners. And I'm proud of the fact that they're prioritized in our metrics, that when we have an exception to begin bringing kids back in, our youngest learners are prioritized as a high priority. And you think about play, that's really critical. So we've done some small groups with our counselors and also some synchronous learning with teachers to help that developmental. So high on our minds. We're keeping our lunch programs going. Food distribution from our food share is already planned through Christmas. I think they're serving or handing out 1,000 or more boxes every week, and that's set to go through December.
We want to drill deeper on this, so we're going to take a quick break, though. But still to come, kids, class, and coronavirus. What parents need to know, minorities and families who live below the poverty line have been some of the hardest hit in this pandemic.
Along with special education students, they are the most vulnerable as we start the year online. And coming up, we'll talk about equality and how the districts are going to guarantee they don't miss out on their education.
We'll be right back.
The COIN Podcast Network is your home for on-demand coverage of local news, sports, weather, and entertainment you won't find anywhere else. You can always find us on coin.com/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Executive producer Ian Costello here, coming to you from the Work From Home COIN Podcast Studios. When we started our podcasts back in February of 2019, we had no idea that we would end up here. Now, a year and a half later, tens of thousands of you are listening to hundreds of our podcasts, and we need to make some changes to grow even further. That's why, starting this week, you can find all of the COIN podcasts in one place. The brand new COIN Podcast Network. From Beaver Smack to Writer's Block. From your weather to our constant coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and the protests in Portland. It is all available in one place. So, to keep hearing the podcasts you already love and to discover more of our exclusive audio content, head to coin.com/podcasts or search COIN, that's K-O-I-N, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, or Podbean. Thank you for listening.
Coronavirus is impacting some of our more marginalized or vulnerable communities and families.
And welcome back to Kids, Class, and Coronavirus, What Parents Need to Know. We're leading a discussion with the superintendents from Portland, Salem-Keizer, Beaverton, and Evergreen school districts.
So in addition to the health and safety of students, families, and staff, our leaders are grappling with how to guarantee quality education for underserved communities. More than 50% of students in Oregon, 44% of students in Washington qualify for free and reduced lunch.
Superintendent Guerrero, I know you've been working hard. You're passionate about making sure every student's needs are met. How do you handle this when you have students who are already struggling because of their economic conditions, and now it's online learning at home? How are you overcoming that?
Well, we know for us here in Portland, our Black, our Native, our students of color, they've been disproportionately impacted by this health pandemic, the economic crisis, their families, as well as this racial uprising. Again, more than ever, it's going to be really important to continue listening to the expressed needs and the lived experience of our communities of color. Certainly, we've heard a few things from some of those focus groups. We know as educators, there's no more important thing than that relationship between teacher, supportive adult, and our students. And we have an opportunity here to leverage all of the assets in the community. And for us, that includes working with our culturally specific partners, for instance, who can provide that family engagement, that mentorship, those check-ins with our students that complement the efforts that our school-based staff, I know, are going to also make attempts at doing. So this really is a time to wrap ourselves around making sure that our most vulnerable students have those supports that will give them an equitable opportunity to access their learning and continue achieving.
I want to go to Don Grotti in Beaverton. So I want to ask you this next question, because you shared with us that you grew up in poverty. I don't know if I'm right, but you didn't have electricity until maybe you were in high school growing up on the Oregon coast. Correct me on what the story is, but a question from parents: so how do you expect kids to keep up and self-teach if a parent is working, unable to assist them with their online schooling, maybe they're hungry? Can you touch on that?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. It's not only our parents that are working, it's our parents who are not working also. And sometimes when you add on, we're wanting them to partner with us in the education of their students, it can be absolutely overwhelming for them. And I'll go back to trying to find those wraparound services that we can alleviate some fears and concerns of those parents. Those parents want the best education for their students as much as our affluent parents. And what we need to do is, what are those things? Is it, you know, basic food staples? Is it a rent, a place to live? I know that just to, for instance, in Beaverton, a lot of people don't know that Beaverton, and I know Salem and Portland are right next to us, but we have the highest homeless population of any school district in the state. And since COVID-19 has come on, we are seeing that grow significantly, especially with our younger families, 3 and 4 year olds. So trying to, once again, challenge our other stakeholders to come to the table. We're really trying to work with our county. We're working with our city, our state, in trying to leverage resources to have a collective impact for our most vulnerable. And those students also include our special education students, our emerging language learner students. All of our districts have newcomers that are coming into our districts from other countries, and they are just right now, they're just in a survival mode. So I did grow up in a family that was in a survival mode. So that part of it, I realize. And what I can tell you, and the counterparts that are here and other school district superintendents around our state and around the country, it is time. Guadalupe said we have an opportunity here. It's time to look at our most marginalized and vulnerable students and make a statement and put our resources that's really going to make a difference for them in this tremendous and horrible time.
Don, you just said it, and our next question comes from a staff member. They write, I work with high school students in special education. Online learning is very hard for them. Has there been any consideration for opening classrooms just for the special education program? So how will you address students who have IEPs in place and their educational minutes are not being met? I have to think this is the hardest question for all of you. And maybe Christy will go to you on this as far as Salem Kaiser is concerned.
Yeah, it is probably the hardest question. And even this spring, you know, one of the things we did is we did a sweep through the district to make sure that any student who had any sort of specialized equipment, communication devices had that in their home. And then our students with disabilities are one of those groups that the minute we meet the exception metrics, we're going to need to find out how to get them in. And I think of it too, for our students with a disability, as all hands on deck. And so in a classroom where you have a licensed teacher, there's also a number of education support professionals that help. And so I know that schools would have the teacher come on, have the support professional reach out to families, and we're just having to be as creative as possible. And then the minute we can begin getting kids back in, that's one of the groups we really need to get back in. And I think a lot kind of on my heart is even like our students with autism who need routine, who need consistency. Well, they're going to be going through a number of transitions. So we're starting comprehensive distance learning. Maybe we can get them back in as in targeted groups. And then if we come in full blended learning, think about the transition for a student who might really struggle with transitions. So we're gonna have to be really explicit with our teacher, super creative and all hands on deck. And I think of that for all of our marginalized groups. How do we provide the basic, but then layer on the supports with other departments, with other specialists within our district, and with our community-based organizations. I know that the Coalition for Equality in our community has done tremendous outreach with our families as well. And so they're kind of on the front lines of that with us. But yeah, it's probably, so many of our kids right now are really on our hearts and in our minds.
I have a question. I'm not sure who to ask this of, but I'm curious. You all are from really big school districts. Mm-hmm. Has anybody recently come from a small school district who's going to have to deal with special ed, and what do you think they are going to do? Jump in if you want to answer that question.
Yeah, let me go ahead and start. I think that the largeness of our systems both is an opportunity and a challenge at the same time. You know, when you think about our largest high school in Salem-Keizer is 2,300 students, and you think about my former district of Dallas, Oregon, where their high school is about 1,000. So when they can begin bringing kids back in to school, they can bring them back in so much more often, because cohorts of 100 are only 10 at a 1,000 student high school. And so I think that the small districts have the opportunity of getting to in-person learning quicker, and the large districts have the opportunity of more real specialists to reach out into our specific groups and our marginalized populations. So I think the small district, there is definitely some advantages. We run the largest transportation system in the Valley, and it's actually larger than Beaverton and Portland Public just because of our larger geography. So when we start thinking about how do you cohort kids and get them on buses and get them into school, again, it's just this huge puzzle where in a 3,000 student district, you have smaller walking or more kids that can walk. Mm-hmm. There's just not the layers of complexity, I think, in a smaller district, even though we all are dealing with the same challenges.
Gotcha. Thank you for your perspective.
Can I add something there? Just from my perspective, because I've been in Evergreen for 20 years, but I've worked in some smaller districts. A lot of it it comes down to the connection, right? It's whether you have a large district, you have a small district, it's that building, making the connection with the parent, making sure that they feel comfortable to have the conversation, letting everyone know what their issues are. We face a lot of the same things. What we never really talked about, logistically, just feeding kids is such a significant thing in this time, because as you mentioned, I think you said all the districts represented here are at or above 50% free and reduced. In a situation where, you know, it's hard to get kids into school to be fed, we've got to be creative and find out ways to make sure that kids can be fed and be taken care of. But it really does come from my perspective, our staff at all levels has to have in their heart that they're there for our kids. We are here for the kids, whether we're a large district or a small district. We wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the students. And in my mind, if we always look at it that way, we're going to find ways to do that. We're creating student engagement teams in our buildings where if we have families that haven't reached out or a student hasn't connected, we're going to make sure within that week we're reaching back out through the teacher, through counselors, through paras that we have. We're doing literally everything we can. And understand that I'm certain Oregon's dealing with the same thing we are in Washington, that is that we're doing this in the face of economic crisis, where we're all facing reductions of revenue and trying to figure out how we're going to do all this. So for me, like I said, as school districts, we wouldn't exist if it wasn't for kids. So we have to figure out at all levels how to take care of our students.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on. So this week, Portland Public Schools announced in a survey that it would offer a childcare option to help parents. And so a viewer asked for Superintendent Guerrero, why is PPS proposing a 5-day per week fee-based, $1,000 a month, a daycare option to assist with kids' online learning, but not able to safely provide for in-person instruction for those kids that want to send kids to school?
Sure. I'll start off by saying school districts in Oregon, particularly in the metro or the cities near health centers, you know, collaborated on making sure that our heroes, our essential workers who are working, serving those that have been affected by this pandemic with making sure that their children had a safe place to be. And I know that school systems stepped up in partnership with licensed childcare providers. And we would all recognize that these are not the ideal conditions for teaching and learning. And as I said earlier, we have to explore all the assets and potential strategies out there that might meet families' needs. And so Portland did put a survey out there around help us gauge what that actual need is, because we're trying to bring partners in the community together who are licensed childcare providers who might be a match to operate in safe ways to serve a segment of our students. We want to make sure that all of our students and families have access to some equitable support. So as I mentioned earlier, some of our focus groups and conversations have elevated that, you know, there's some level of need for safe places to learn and get tutoring. So what I'm saying here is, we're exploring what are some options that some essential workers, including our employees, we're asking to be in front of our students all day. What options might exist for them? Are they interested? How might this be resourced? And so hopefully we'll be able to propose some actual menu options to families that are feasible. And that's what we're looking at right now.
Are any of other districts looking at the childcare option right now? Mike?
Yeah, well, we're looking at working with the local partners potentially in our schools. We wouldn't staff it ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I saw you raise your hand, Don. Beaverton's thinking about that?
Yeah, so we already, like Guadalupe, I imagine Christy also, we have outside providers serving essential workers in two of our sites right now. We have a total of 10 daycare providers, but the two are serving all day. And most of our daycare providers, they're equipped for usually before and after school services. And now the idea to ramp up where all day, it takes some time. And in addition, we are reaching out to some specific community stakeholders, and we are seeing what we can do. I know we've been in contact with our county commissioners. They're interested in trying to support us in various ways, as our city is also. And so we're trying to find out how we can garner some additional resources for Beaverton. And when we're talking about our employees, we will be allowing some of our employees to work from home, and or if they would like to come in to the bricks and mortar, they'll be able to do that depending on different health requirements of each employee. And I think for all of us, first and foremost, is the health and safety of our students and our staff. And the only other thing I would want to say, and I think we would all say that, is we have a better idea about this distance learning when we go out, and don't sell our staff short. We have some amazing educators, we have amazing support staff, and we have some amazing administrators. And we are going to be better. We are going to do better because our kids deserve it.
Yes. So we have a lot of questions about the return someday to in-person learning, student safety, and what if you have to quarantine, and a lot of questions.
Yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics is advocating to return to the classroom, and we'll talk about that when we come back.
We'll be right back.
The COIN Podcast Network is your home for on-demand coverage of local news, sports, weather, and entertainment you won't find anywhere else. You can always find us on coin.com/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Executive producer Ian Costello here, coming to you from the Work From Home COIN Podcast Studios. When we started our podcasts back in February of 2019, we had no idea that we would end up here. Now, a year and a half later, tens of thousands of you are listening to hundreds of our podcasts, and we need to make some changes to grow even further. That's why, starting this week, you can find all of the COIN podcasts in one place. The brand new COIN Podcast Network. From Beaver Smack to Writer's Block. From your weather to our constant coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and the protests in Portland. It is all available in one place. So, to keep hearing the podcasts you already love and to discover more of our exclusive audio content,
head to coin.com/podcasts or search COIN, that's K-O-I-N, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, or Podbean. Thank you for listening.
How are we reopening all of these businesses and bars and water parks and Disneyland before we reopen schools?
Welcome back to Kids, Class, and Coronavirus, What Parents Need to Know. Governor Brown has set benchmarks that our local school districts really will not meet in the next few weeks to open in person. And Governor Inslee in Washington strongly recommended that schools in his area begin with online learning. So how important is it that we get students back into the classroom sometime this school year?
Right. It seems like Oregon's getting more clear guidance right now than Washington. Yeah. That's my sense. Let's have Guadalupe Guerrero answer this question first, because he is in charge of the largest school district in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, I appreciate the some of the statements that the Pediatrics Association has issued. I think it's really important to offer the fuller picture of what they are saying, along with national superintendents and teachers associations, that of course the well-being, the development, the learning, all those things are best had under normal circumstances on campus. But we shouldn't return to campus unless the evidence, the data, the health metrics suggest it's safe to do so. Or we fall prey to some of the partisan politics that are going on there. And thankfully, collaborating with our governor and our Department of Education, we agree that we ought to make those decisions based on some health metrics. We know that that kind of a phased reopening criteria, you know, applies differently across the state, not just for businesses, but a similar logic model for how we consider when it's time for us to be ready to open up school districts. In Portland, it would be safe to assume that that might mean, unless things really improve and we get a lot of community cooperation, that conditions may not allow us to open earlier than we would prefer to. So, we're going to continue to be fact-based about those considerations and continue to evaluate and assess, and we'll rely on public health and the team of medical experts that we're relying on.
Christy Perry from Salem Kaiser, I want to ask you the same question, because we already touched on that. It was 70% of your students have free or reduced lunch, a lot of vulnerable kids. How important is it to you in your mind to get the kids physically back in the classroom?
Yeah, I think it's second to having it be safe to do so. So critically important, especially for our youngest learners. But we also have to remember, while we have this high level of poverty, they're also some of the most affected kids and families for COVID. So, and which is what we see play out in the metrics, right? So we know that teaching kids to read is can happen way quicker with in-person learning. What I appreciate the most about the way Oregon is approaching it is, one, based on metrics, science, health experts. And number two, it does give us the chance to bring back in those targeted groups of students when things start to get better. And what I think that does for us too is it allows us to practice our protocols. So, you know, making sure kids understand how they wear their face coverings, practice lunch, practice the cleaning and the classrooms and the movement among buildings. So I think that critical, important, and our exception metrics in Oregon will give us a chance to bring in some of our kids that need it the most sooner than we bring in all of our 42,000 kids.
Okay, we touched on this just a little bit, but a parent writes, why isn't going to school considered essential when daycare, liquor stores, pot shops are all open? Why can't we develop social distancing and protective face masks for children when they're required to do in public spaces? Do all of you think enough effort went into prioritizing schools? Is it possible to send kids back if we could social distance and face masks? Or is it just an impossibility right now? Maybe not down the road, but right now. Who would like to take that on? Mike, we haven't heard from you in a while. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great, I appreciate that. That's a good question for me to take. I guess the way I would answer it is, I think if there had been priorities around making school the first place to come back, those other things might not have opened the way that they opened, which would have kept the rates of spread down to levels where, like in the metrics in Washington, would allow or more on-site student delivery, education delivery of students. So I can't explain why the things the pot shops and liquor stores seem to be more important than having kids in school. I don't think it probably makes sense to any of us, but I think it's important for us in Evergreen. The metrics you mentioned, they are a little different in Washington, and they maybe aren't as strict or stringent as what they might be in Oregon. And so I think we do have opportunities to bring kids in. So because of the phase that we're in Clark County in phase two, we do plan on, as soon as we possibly can in September, getting students in groups of five or less, whether that's kindergartners that have never had any kind of contact with the school system. Very important for them to get in and meet their teachers. First graders, I've got a kindergarten daughter, Sophia, this past year, that it was very difficult for her in the spring, and even my third grade daughter, Olivia. You know, so we want to identify and give hope to our kids that they will be coming back to school. So I think what Christy said, bringing kids in small groups, gives us opportunities to refine the protocols. We all, I'm sure, have the same protocols around the attestations, the temperature checks, the staggered starts, the how we're cleaning buses, how we're cleaning classrooms, the flow through a building, washing hands, all of those things. Well, if you start with five kids, it's going to be easier when you get to bringing back 10 mm-hmm. and when you get to be bringing back 15. So I don't know that was a great answer for why our pot shops open in schools aren't, but that's the way we're looking at it in Evergreen.
Donna from Beaverton, I want to ask you something. The president talked about it today, saying something about that teachers union cares more about the teachers and not what's best for the students. I don't want to get political here, but one of the questions we get is keeping the schools closed more to protect the teachers, or is it more to protect the kids? Can you even make that determination?
First of all, I don't think that there's not another group out there that wants to be in the classroom with their kids than our teachers. They had significant withdrawals. If you can imagine a classroom teacher not being able to tell their class goodbye at the end of the year. So I think that it's for both that get right to your question. I think it's for the safety of our students and the safety of our teachers. But there's nobody that wants to be back in their classrooms more than our teachers. They do want to be there safe. And we want to make sure that when we do go back, that we get to come back and we have a pretty good chance of staying back. It's incumbent on all of us, not just schools, our communities and everybody, the social distancing, adhere to those standards that are set and have been proven to eliminate this COVID or drastically reduce it, so we get to the metrics that we can come back and we can come back safe and we can be there for sustained time. So I would disagree. Definitely, I know union leadership, they want to protect their employees and they should, but I think it's not good to say that, you know, these teachers do not want to be back in the classroom. They are dying to be back in the classroom. And some of these teachers are doing amazing jobs of reaching out on their own time, outside of their contract time, trying to make connections with families and students. So we just want to come back safe and we want it to be prolonged.
And I've seen that. I've had three teachers in my neighborhood that are doing exactly what Don says. They're just amazing people. Here's another question. If and when students return, and let's say someone gets sick in your student's cohort, who will have to quarantine? Will both cohorts be sent home since they share a teacher? Guadalupe, I guess I'll throw that out to you, and maybe you don't really have a good answer for that because we're trying to predict the future here. We just don't know.
Appreciate your last couple of questions around why aren't schools priorities, and you brought up politics since you're going to open up that door. I'm not sure why Congress isn't acting to make sure that public education has the sufficient and robust investments to make sure safety protocols, sufficient staff, supports for students most vulnerable at this time. We're trying to make it work under the circumstances, the variables, the factors that we have. Until the community also prioritizes the health and safety of one another, It's true. If we open too soon, and we've seen this happen in other places around the country, we could be having to sort of put folks in quarantine. And the challenges with contact tracing, I don't know if folks have been on a school campus lately, but they're social enterprises. If you haven't been in a kindergarten class, it's a little bit, imagine, you know, 2 dozen 5-year-olds in plexiglass bubbles. It's just not realistic. That's the whole point of social development. So we want to make sure that we're prepared to maintain that health and safety. We don't want to have these relapses. We don't want to have to close down schools. We don't want to open up before we're ready to. And this is why those health metrics are important. We want to get to a level, and hopefully there'll be a vaccine soon. That should help, where we can sustain the opening of school.
All right, this hour went very, very quickly. Okay, we're going to put you all on the spot. If you don't want to answer the question, just shake your head.
Just raise your hand.
Yeah. Raise your hand if you think kids will be back in school this school year.
And that's the problem here. We just can't predict the future. This is so out of our control. And we want to thank everyone in our panel for joining us tonight. We covered a whole lot of ground. And this is a conversation that will continue in the coming weeks and throughout the school here.
Right, we want to leave you with a final thought from Providence Behavioral Health Chief, Executive Dr. Robin Henderson.
You know, I don't have a great crystal ball, but here's what I do know. I know that kids are resilient and kids are adaptable. And our kids and our generations of kids lived through the 1918 flu pandemic. They lived through the Great Depression. People lived through World War I and World War II and lived through times when different circumstances would not allow them to socialize in the ways that they're used to socializing. But I guarantee you, they're going to be strong, they're going to be amazing, and they're going to be next level thinkers who think differently about problems than we ever could.
Once again, thanks to our panel for this very important Coin 6 Town Hall.
I think one thing we learned tonight, this is an evolving situation.
Yes.
There's going to have to be a lot of flexibility, and the future is definitely unknown.
Special thanks to Coin 6 News Special Projects producer, Bethany Austin, for her tremendous work putting together this town hall. You can find all of your back-to-school resources anytime by visiting coin.com. That does it for Friday, August 7th. Thank you for listening to the Coin Podcast Network. We will talk to you soon.
Coin 6 Podcast Network is your home for all sorts of content you can't find anywhere else. Visit coin.com/podcast to see our entire library. This digital presentation is copyrighted by Nexstar Media Group. Any other use of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.